Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate, and everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program.
We've got all three of those things in spades, and in his latest book, I forget the name of it, he highlighted the U.S. is looking very much now like it did on those factors in the period 1850 to 1855. And obviously, 1860 to 65 in this country were catastrophic.
Welcome, everyone, to the Finance University podcast, one of the many offerings by Peak Prosperity. I am your host, Dr. Chris Martinson. And remember, nothing in this podcast shall be construed as financial advice. Everything is offered purely for your education, and that all financial decisions should be undertaken in consultation with your financial advisor. Now, today's interview is the one we've all been waiting for. As you know, our view at Peak Prosperity is that you have to connect the dots, right? You got to see across the silos of information to have any hope of making any sense out of today's hyper-complicated world. Luke Grohman, with over 20 years of experience in the sector, has been one of the most respected names in global research, having an unparalleled ability to make broad connections between the information silos, and then, most importantly, drawing the conclusions that help investors understand the bigger picture so they can take actions. You can find his excellent, excellent work at fftt-llc.com. That's fftt-llc.com. Near and dear to my heart is that Luke Grohman is able also to study the role of energy in supporting economic activity. Thank you. Without getting, triggered and resorting to technological hopium as an emotional coping mechanism. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Chris. It's great to be here.
Now, you have a really excellent slideshow up that's at your site, and it's talking about the role of peak cheap energy. I dare say that we actually saw the word peak in an oil headline in the Wall Street Journal recently. The idea is circulating back around. Can you just give us your views on where we are actually in this energy story right now and how you connect that across silos to the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I think we're in a peak cheap oil world, which is to say, not that we're running out of the stuff, but we're running out of the cheap stuff, and the marginal cost of production and discovery in dollars is rising and will likely continue to rise. And that is what it is. It isn't necessarily catastrophic or problematic, were it not for the structure of the economy and the debt levels of the economy. In other words, we need to find more oil to drive the growth of the economy in order to sustain the record levels of debt that we have really across the economy, but in particular in sovereign debt and in the West. And so we need more and more oil, which means we need higher and higher priced oil over time, in order to make economic the incremental oil discovery, production, et cetera, of producing the oil. The challenge is on the other side of that, the second derivative, which is as this happens, given the high levels of debt in the system, and in particular sovereign debt levels, the price of oil that the bond market can withstand without beginning to dysfunction is coming down and down and down over time. We've seen our work, we go back 60 years. And what we found pretty consistently is anytime you get U.S. oil consumption as a percent of U.S. GDP much over 3%, you go into a recession. You basically start going into stagflation. The drag on economic growth gets too great. So, and that creates problems in bond markets, inflation, et cetera. So you need to keep the U.S. consumption of oil, which is just barrels per day times price, to, times 365 days, divided by GDP, you need to keep that number below 3%. And the challenge in doing that is that as the price rises and consumption rises, you need to find productivity on the other side at an even faster rate. And at the same time, the growth in debt is making the need for you to do that at a faster rate, at a faster rate. So you basically have two lines that are, as we were talking about just off air, a ceiling and a floor. And the ceiling is the price of oil that triggers bond market dysfunction. We saw this last fall that once oil got over $90, the bond market started dysfunctioning in a major way because foreign holders of U.S. treasuries that are also oil importers, Japan, China, much of Europe, Korea, they need to start selling treasuries to buy oil. Their current account gets into a deficit from a surplus due to the higher price of oil. They need to sell treasury bonds to raise dollars to buy oil. So we saw last fall that once oil got much over $85, $90, the bond market started dysfunctioning. The long-term treasury market crashed 20% nearly in the third quarter of 2023. So that price, that $85 to $90 magic price, will come down over time as the amount of debt goes up. That's just a leverage issue. So the ceiling of this dynamic is the price of oil that, for lack of a better word to be flipped, blows up the bond market. And that's coming down and to the right over time as I look at it. And this floor is the price of oil that you need in order to incent producers who have a longer capital cycle. As you know, this is not a short cycle business. Once it's installed, shale, there's a little bit of a shorter cycle. But the energy business is a long cycle business. And so the price of oil is that you need to incent increasing production of oil to support the debt is your floor. And your floor is moving up and to the right. And those two lines are converging toward each other. I don't think the lines have quite crossed over yet, but sort of once they do cross over, where you know the price of oil that you need to grow production is higher than the price of oil that blows up the bond market, that's where you better have restructured your currency system, your monetary system before then. There are things they can do. There's things, to my eyes, I think they are doing to restructure this system. And that's something we can talk on further. But that's how I'm looking at the interplay, the core part of the interplay between energy, peak cheap oil, and the economy more broadly.
Yeah, you know, there are theories out there, Luke, that there's plenty of oil, and I wouldn't disagree. I know there's some basins out there. The Middle East has not even begun to drill for their own shale beds, which I know they have, and Russia as well. But my argument is that there isn't more oil at this price, right? So offshore drilling is kind of the nuclear baseload, typically. Big, long capital cycles, 5-7 years to sort of find it and get it into production, $100 million drill rigs, yada, yada. They need $100+ oil. You can look at the stock price. This isn't a recommendation, but if you just anybody wants to look at rig, right? Transocean's just gotten crushed, right? Because nobody's doing offshore drilling because the price is not conducive for that. Like it just doesn't pencil out at these prices. Would you agree that there's maybe more oil out there, but not at these prices?
I think not in the volumes that you need to both support the economics I just laid out before, and to offset what is commonly known in the industry as the treadmill or the Red Queen problem, right? Where I think it was Diamondback a couple weeks ago came out and said that their production, their legacy production in the Permian, which is one of the biggest basins in the world, it is by far the biggest basin in the U.S., is declining at a 31% annual rate. Right. So I don't know that the whole basin is declining at that rate. I don't know if there's something specific to their geology, their locations. I don't know the company that well, but that they had that in a presentation. And so you not only have to grow production to support the economy, but you have to grow production to offset the loss of production from U.S. shale, which is, however many millions of barrels declining at probably if you just shut it down, it'd probably decline at a 15 to 25% annual rate, I would guess. And it would be a front-end loaded decline, right? So the pace of decline declines as time goes on. But then the thing that people tend to forget, there's, I think, a much greater awareness about the treadmill problem in shale, which is a big enough problem itself because it has been 80 to 90% of global oil production growth over the last decade, according to Goering and Rosenzweig. There's still the legacy 85 million barrels a day, or 82 or 87, whatever it is, the conventional stuff that the Saudis are saying is declining anywhere from 3 to 6. And so you have to offset this decline and then also find enough to support the growth, to support the debt. So at current prices, I don't think the economic incentive is there. And the other issue too is, as a capital allocator, that, Wall Street, we tend to live, quarter to quarter or month to month, and what's the comp and this. But we tend to forget, again, it's a long cycle business. These are capital allocators with massive amounts of capital. When you are presented with a situation where the geopolitics and the volatility of oil prices are high, so you not only need higher oil prices, you need higher oil prices with lower volatility. Because if oil goes to 120 and it comes back to 70, I can't, as a capital allocator, look out. I need to make 10, 20, 30, 40-year capital allocations with an underlying commodity that has a volatility that goes 70 to 120 to 70 to 90. I'm better off putting the money in 5.25 T-bills and just waiting until oil is at 120, 140 and stays there at relatively lower volatility. Then I can take the money out of T-bills, and it's a much lower risk proposition. So to answer your question directly, no, I don't think the price is high enough yet. It's a great point. I agree entirely with what you're saying on rig. That would be the message of that, in my opinion. So that's the situation we're in.
So if let's widen out a tiny bit, because I know you can do this easily, and we'll be able to add a lot to this conversation that I don't know. But when I look at this, Luke, the United States, I think, has been selling itself this idea, Saudi America, right? And we've got plenty for long enough. And very quietly, the EIA has been saying, oh, they see a plateau now, a bumpy plateau, which, as you know, Goering and Rosenzweig have said, yeah, you just add up the shale acreage, and we are now at that awkward bumpy plateau. We're not going to get 30% per year, gains and output. All right. The United States is still a net oil importer for the grades of oil we need, which is, medium and heavy stuff. We have all this light stuff coming out of the Eagle Ford. We send that off to other people because we can't use it. So when I widen out and I look at this, I see that China is now, bar none, the number one importer of oil. It feels to me like we're setting up for a geopolitical showdown, because I don't think the United States has. Well, what have we done? We've drained our SPR, right? Specifically to drive the price of oil down, so that, and as we just talked about, that leads to the spillover derivative effect of not getting more oil exploration, which is a long cycle thing, which you need. I add that up and I say, wow, I could see a real calamity. Not that, once oil spikes, we won't get more, but that's in several years from now. It feels like our bond market is extraordinarily at risk during that gap between, when the crisis erupts and when more oil comes out of the ground. That feels like a multi-year, 3, 4 year hole to me. How do you see that playing out?
I agree that the bond market would not like oil at 110 to 120 or more, and in reality, it's probably 95, 95 or more on a sustained basis. And at that point, it just becomes a question: what does the U.S. want to do? And having run down the SPR, there will be some flux up of shale, but it's probably not going to be enough if it's a more structural issue. Then it's a question of: do you want to save the bond market or do you want to save the currency? And in my opinion, they have proven to us they are going to save the bond market. In other words, they will have a choice as yields go 4, 4.5, 5. It's probably 5% now, but I think they showed us the number last fall on the 10-year treasury yield. But as yields start to tick up, there is a yield where the Fed comes in and says no more. This is the top of the yield for the 10-year, for the policy, for the real economy policy rate of the United States. And our balance sheet will be the release valve. And we will buy everything we have to in order to facilitate this. And then you see the currency fall. The dollar falls against oil, inflation picks up, and you will lose a lot of money on a real basis on bonds, but you won't lose any money nominally. Your gasoline will be $6 and your bond fund and your 401k will show just clipping along and, flat performance with a 5% coupon. And they have showed us repeatedly, U.S. policymakers have showed investors repeatedly since fall of 2019. When push comes to shove, we have a choice between the bond market and the currency. Repo rate spike at the front end. Repo rates went to 8 to 10% in September 2019. It took them 48 hours to begin stopping QT and reversing it and begin regrowing their balance sheet. That was strike one. Strike two was March of 2020 in COVID. Bond markets bid at the bottom or near the peak of the COVID crisis in March of 2020, the bond market crashed. The Fed's own minutes said the Treasury market effectively ceased to function, the off-the-run Treasury market. They came in, $600 billion a week in QE. Strike two. We saw it again in September 2022. We saw the volatility in U.S. Treasury market. The MOVE Volatility Index was hitting levels that signified, according to the creator of that index, that they were this close to losing control of the bond market. Again, this time it wasn't the Fed, it was Treasury. At the time, I was looking for the Fed to come in and begin regrowing their balance sheet. I was wrong. It was Treasury. Yellen went to Washington, had a meeting at the IMF, comes away from that, and the dollar falls 35% on an annualized rate over the next 4 months as she runs down the Treasury general account to basically, again, currency or bond market, strike three. We come to 1Q23. What was called a banking problem was not really a banking problem, it's a Treasury problem. The Fed could have said, stand aside. Sorry, banks. Yeah, we told you to buy all these treasuries. It's like Otter said in Animal House.
You effed up.
You effed up. You trusted us. Sell it, right? And oh, by the way, yep. Oprah, I know you have $800 million in the bank. Sorry, we told you we were only going to guarantee up to $250,000. You lose. Venture capitalists with your $1.2 or $2 billion in funds in these banks that were in trouble. We told you, $250,000. Does that mean you have to wind up companies, shut stuff down? We told you. That's what had to happen. Strike four. They didn't. They did BTFP, which was a bailout of the Treasury market for banks. It was basically yield curve control in the Treasury market for U.S. domiciled banks. Then you go to the fall. We have MOVE Volatility Index. Again, get up near the level they're losing control in early October. In 9 trading days, 7 different Fed governors came out and said the bond market has done our job for us. And then Yellen came out and shifted to the issuance from the long end to the short end of the Treasury curve, much more than anybody was expecting. And weakened the dollar, reduced duration, increased bank reserves, run down the reverse repo, basically. They addressed the increased bill issuance with the reverse repo. That was essentially QE. That was strike five, right? In baseball, you only get 3 strikes. So the market has kind of figured this out, I think, which is to say when push comes to shove, bond market or currency, they're going to choose the bond market. And I think the market sees this, knows this. And so whether it's oil, as your initial question said, that spikes up and creates a run on yields, or whether it's an issuance problem, or whether it's a recession, or whether it's a geopolitical issue, anything that causes dysfunction in the bond market, they're not going to abide that. They're going to effectively intervene to constrain yields, and the release valve will be the currency. And I think that's what we're seeing, right? Since November, we can see what equity markets have done. We can see what Bitcoin has done. We can see what gold has done. Oil has been, pretty strong given China has been soft. Europe has been soft, etc. And I think that's the world we're in with a lot of volatility.
So October 31st, things are really starting to shred back in November, October 2023. November is just scalded ape time, right? So you just mentioned gold, Bitcoin, NVIDIA, lots of, I look at these charts, Luke, and I'm like, wow, I've seen these before. Some of them look very tulipy, right? But is that the is there something happening behind the scenes where somebody dumped a lot of liquidity in that I don't know about out here in the cheap seats? Or was that the market correctly interpreting Strike 5 and saying, oh, I want to hold things that are going to now do very well in a currency debasement regime? What do you think is the story there?
I think it's the latter. If you take a step back and look at what the effects of QE are, you have a reduction in net issuance of long duration treasuries because the Fed's buying them. The Fed's actions of buying them they loosen financial conditions. They create bank reserves, just the accounting transaction increases bank reserves, and stock prices go up. That's what happens in QE. Bernanke said back in 2010 or 2011, it's one of the goals. Like, we need to get stock price up. Okay, so when Yellen shifted from the back end to the front end, what did we get? Basically, began drawing down reverse repo aggressively. Okay, so we have a reduction in net issuance at the long end. Check. The reverse repo is, again, accounting is out of reverse repo into T-bills, and then it's spent by the government, and it goes into bank reserves. Bank reserves up, financial conditions loosen, stock prices up. It was just QE called another name. It was just sort of a stealth or synthetic QE, as I've called it before. So I think that's what the market saw, was that was the source of liquidity. But I do also think it was the market saying, okay, we know this movie, we've seen this movie, and anytime that bond market gets too dysfunctional, it's like a dinner bell in front of a hungry wolf, because they just know it's one of these trades in a very tough business. It's one of these trades that's very close to a sure thing, which is to say, there's no government in history that I'm aware of with a fiat currency that has defunded itself for lack of printing money. It always prints the money. Mm. And so once you get the treasury dysfunction to a certain level, as a practical matter, the U.S. government spends 120, 125% on just three things now. Entitlements, it's about 70, 75% of tax receipts. Interest, it's about another 20, 25% of tax receipts. And defense, which used to be one of the biggest line items, is now down to third, is 20% roughly of receipts. So as a and then everything else, like the next biggest thing is like 4-3%. Like, there's nothing else that even touches it. And so the point here is that if once the bond market gets dysfunctional, your decision set as a macro investor gets very binary. Are they going to cut entitlements aggressively and immediately and permanently in an election year? Nah, the odds of that are almost nothing. Are they going to cut defense in a geopolitical tightening or toughening? No. In an election year? No. Or are they going to cut rates? One way or another, yes, that's the only thing. And if they can't cut rates, then what's the only other release of? Has to be the dollar. They either have to cut rates or weaken the dollar. And quite frankly, it's six of one or half dozen of the other in terms of the implication for macro positioning. So that's what I think markets are increasingly playing by, this new set of rules, which is the whole market. Right. This is we're in a very different scenario. By virtue of us having the stock bubble in 2000 kicking upstairs to the banking system and creating a housing bubble, and then we kick that upstairs to the sovereign, and now we have a sovereign debt bubble. In the meantime, corporate America termed out their debt in 2000. They are termed out. Will they have a problem eventually? Absolutely. But this is all just a pain contest. This is just who's, you know, everyone's jumped off the 100th floor. Who's falling fastest and first, and whose chute's going to open? Mm-hmm. Corporate America termed out their debt. Households largely termed out their debt. You know, their biggest debt is I think still on average for is still your house. And most people have termed that out. So it's a pain contest. And the U.S. government consistently is the one that's going to be in pain first. Except they have a printing press. This isn't 08. Lehman didn't have a printing press. Homeowners didn't have a printing press. This isn't 2000. You know, Pets.com didn't have a printing press. So the guy who's going to be in pain first because they didn't term out their debt in 2020, the U.S. government, is going to be in pain first, fastest, and they have a printing press. And that's how this keeps playing out. I think the market's going, oh, I got it. Okay, great. So all I have to do is structure my position so that I don't go bust in the periods of time when there's disruptions for a month or 2 or 3 months. But we've seen the U.S. government has not been able to go more than 2-3 months at most of treasury dysfunction. And those periods are shrinking. And pretty soon there's going to be no period they can even withstand because the debt keeps getting higher and higher. Energy mm-hmm. is a forcing function under all this. So I think it's I think that's what we're seeing. And to your point, I think we're in still very early days of this.
Fascinating. I mean, it really aligns with a lot of how I see the world. So I like it. Here's the question. We have debts have been compounding at close to 9% for 50 years, and our economy is a fraction of that, even on nominal terms. So you can't mathematically have debts compounding faster than your income, which is GDP in this story. And GDP itself is an artifice in the sense that the government goes into debt to create more of it. So I think that in a fair world, we would factor that out and call that not real. But that's okay. Different argument. So I see debts growing exponentially, right? And under that, you know, how do you support that? Well, they've had steadily declining interest rates for a long time over that same period of time, right? From 1980 through to current. So I see how those both those things can persist. And now we're in a rising interest rate regime, some battles going on at the edges. I don't see how that pencils out. It feels to me like what you're saying. I get the sense of the little Dutch boy. He's run out of fingers. There's 12 leaks in the dike. And he's swapping fingers for the next biggest leak. You know, we're going to drain the repo. We're going to do this treasury shenanigans. We're just playing this all out. So if that's the story, let me ask you this. If you're in their shoes, what is their end game? How do they see this resolving? How does this not become just a perpetual treadmill of finger poking until the whole thing blows up or in this metaphor, the dike crumbles, right? So what's the end game? What are they hoping for here?
Two more years. Two more years of that sweet, sweet gravy train with biscuit wheels that is Washington, D.C. That's what they're hoping for, which is why they're not dealing with the issues. And to your point, you know, the problem with, you know, getting on a plane from Cleveland where I am and flying at 1,000 feet, navigating by looking at the ground, you know, heading west, which is essentially what they've been doing. So eventually you hit this little town called Denver and its elevation is 5,000 feet. And if you're still navigating by looking at the ground, flying at 1,000 feet, you know, you'll be hearing the instrument panel warning, and then boom, there's nothing. And that's, we're getting, you know, there are so many signs on the instrument panel flashing. And in the end, it requires... You can extend and pretend a lot of this stuff, right, with the government accounting and this, but it's where these issues interface with the real world where the problems come. Energy, you know, the BTUs, the compounding interest, the cash flows need to support. Those are, you know, I've said, I just wrote a report for clients a few weeks ago, compounding interest is undefeated against empires. The debt doesn't care. It doesn't sleep. Yep. And so... that's where you run into these issues. What are they hoping for? What's the end game? I do think it's basically two more years. What is the end game is the end game is the ultimate sort of showdown, which is the bond market or the currency. We've had this currency and most investors in the West are still credulous that, oh, don't worry. The Fed will fight inflation. They literally can't. The way the system is structured, they can't. They have to make you believe they're independent. They have to make you believe they will, that they will preserve the real value of your... And in brief periods of time, they actually will. However, in the end, the big showdown, the big moment is the one big bond market or currency decision. It's yield curve control, where it's explicit yield curve control, which they want to avoid like the plague, because for them, that's the Hotel California. They can check in, but they can never leave. They are going to have every bond market put to them, treasuries, mortgages, corporates, every bond. And oh, by the way, because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, foreign dollar bonds will effectively get put to them. And their balance sheet will go up 10x in a compressed period of time. And that, I think, is ultimately what the end game most likely looks like. There are some productivity miracles that could change the timing of that or alter it substantially. Basically pushing that big, in poker, the big call, right? Some point they run out of fingers, they run out of liquidity, and they either have to print the money or trigger the revolution, basically. They have to let the bond market go and yields go, or they let the currency go. And like I said before, the list of current countries with a fiat currency that have chosen defund ourselves to preserve the real value of the bond market, it's a very, very short list. I am unaware that anyone has ever done that. And so then if we understand that, then we can, then it becomes a game of managing our chips as investors in terms of, okay, staying liquid enough, understanding there's going to be periods of inflation, disinflation on an overall period of secularly rising inflation, because that's what secularly rising debt will require to float.
Now, thanks for that. Very, very clear. I love it. Luke, when I really want to get my bear suit on and just totally bear out on the markets, I have a firm I turn to now that just delivers. They give me the data, and that's the Congressional Budget Office. In December of 22, they said, oh, hey, little thing, the Social Security Trust Fund, which isn't a trust fund, it's just a stack of IOUs from one branch of the government to another. But they said, by the way, that taps out in 2033, which is right around the corner as far as I'm concerned. And then recently they just said, oh, hey, structurally, for the next 10 years, the United States is going to add another at least $20 trillion of debt. And that's exclusive of any recession that might drive that number higher for reasons, right? Lower receipts and higher expenditures. So I look at those two things, and my question is, who actually is owning a 30-year treasury bond now? Who buys those things and holds on to them?
There are some amount of entities that have duration matching liabilities, right? So some life insurance companies, pension funds, where that can make some sense relative to their obligations. Short of that, I don't know. I don't understand why you would own a 10-year treasury at 4.1% or whatever it is today, when you can get 5.25% in the money markets. That makes less than 0 cents to me for the average investor. I mean, 0 cents. So, to me, it doesn't make sense. When I look at that CBO report, it was fascinating to me, right? It's their 10-year outlooks are always X recession, right? So you can see the revenues go up every year for 10 years, no recessions, which has never happened, but it's fine. It helps us understand. And in that, they expect 20 trillion more in debt. So 2 trillion more a year, roughly, over 10 years. And they expect the deficit, fiscal deficit, to still be 6.1% of GDP in 2034, despite no recessions, and 20 trillion increase in debt. And this one, to me, this is the piece de resistance. This is excellent. They expect the 10-year treasury yield to average 3.8%, which was 40 basis points below where it was when they produced that report. Now it's 30 basis points below. It's like the old Sesame Street game. When I was growing up, they had the little segment of one of these things is not like the others, and one of these things doesn't belong. Those four things cannot happen unless there's some sort of yield curve control, periodic QE, sustained inflation, sustained negative real rates, somebody's sitting on the 10-year treasury yield curve by printing money. Then it makes perfect sense. I would argue that they're, if that's why the 10-year is at 3.8, I would argue that their growth estimates are probably understated. You could probably see more growth, higher receipts, lower deficits. It's just a tuning mechanism, right? I could get rid of the deficit tomorrow. Yellen can get rid of the deficit tomorrow. The budget can certainly, right? So we saw in 2020, we came out of basically a $3.1 trillion annual run rate, I believe, deficit, fiscal deficit. And by the end of 21, for that fiscal reporting year, we were down to like $1.4 trillion. They dropped $1.7 trillion in deficit. Some of that was the economy coming back on, but some of it was they inflated the heck out of everything, and the Fed didn't let interest rates move. And we can stress test this hypothesis in the other direction, because we can see when the Fed started tightening aggressively in 2022, the deficit doubled. It went from 1.1 or whatever to almost 2 trillion. And we know that a lot of the government accountants were surprised by this because they were busy in September when the fiscal numbers came out. They said, oh my God, it's 2 trillion deficit. Where did this come from? To me, it was the least surprising thing in the world. We were telling our clients, like, this is a mistake. The Fed tightening too soon is a mistake. They need to let inflation go. They need to let 8 to 10% inflation now in 2021, 22, because if they don't, they're going to create a problem and they're going to need 20% inflation. And then if they don't let it go then, they'll create a problem and they'll need 40% inflation. And at some point, the market's just going to go, oh, we're done. So basically, their inability to take fair degree of inflation pain in the short run means they've really set themselves up in a corner in the intermediate term. So back to the point, which is we saw the deficit go from 1.1 trillion to 2 trillion when stock prices went down, when bond prices went down, home prices went down. So if you create a bubble, it sets this very, this paradox. They've allowed the system to evolve in such a way that the stock market essentially backs the treasury market. Asset prices essentially back the treasury market. People say, well, let's crash stocks and that'll scare people into treasuries. No, it won't. No, it won't, because stocks are now the biggest marginal driver to receipts, GDP growth, consumer spending. So if stocks fall, GDP is going to fall. And given the leverage in the system, your issuance is going to rise more than you have in terms of people flooding into treasuries. You go into a debt death spiral if you try to crash stocks into treasuries. So basically, the asset prices back treasury market. So you need asset prices to rise by 10, 15, 20% per year and accelerating just to keep the debt situation whole. So if you juice, if Yellen and Powell combined and basically juiced the stock market, right? They weaken the dollar, they do yield curve control. You know, if the dollar was at 60 DXY, we'd probably be running close to a flat deficit. You know, we might even be running a little surplus. The flip side is DXY at 115, you're going to be in a death spiral.
But at 60, oil then becomes twice as expensive, roughly.
Yeah. Yep. Which, oh, by the way, is like what every administration says we need to be doing in terms of the green transition and climate change and all these things. Like, that's how you get people to change. You make it really friggin' expensive to drive. Now, the problem here, it's not a problem per se, but that goes back to our initial point, which is the bond market can't handle that. You've got to deal with the bond market. You got to get the debt down on a real basis first before you do that, or else the math doesn't make sense. Or you need to change how you price oil, you need to delever massively before you do that, because otherwise you create more problems than you solve. But you're exactly right. Yeah, oil would be a lot more expensive.
Now, I often say that if I was going to coach a young person, relationship goals in life are to find somebody who loves you, like the Federal Reserve loves the financial markets, you know, because they put all their effort there. But I can go to the Fred website and discover that 92.5% of all equities are owned by the top 10% of families. And I can go over to TikTok and see people 40 and under just crying about how they're earning good salaries, but they can't move out of mom and dad's basement and they can't get a life going on. So it really feels like there's a political dimension to this where it's becoming obvious to people that the Federal Reserve has said, we're going to protect the financial markets at the expense of young people, household formation. I don't remember voting for them at all, but let alone voting for them to be social engineers. But this is increasingly having that political component. How do you factor that in to their decision making? Does it?
Well, I think it does. I don't think they start from, we want to protect the 10%. I think that's a outcome of what they do, which is we need to protect the treasury market. And we need to finance the government. And then the natural outgrowth of that ends up benefiting the top 10% to the detriment of the bottom 90% and certainly the bottom 50-60%. It's a challenging thing that is not it's easy to break down into sort of black and white, but I think it's the wrong thing to do, because then you say, okay, if the Fed is acting to protect the treasury market and finance U.S. government deficits, where are U.S. government deficits? And the answer goes back to, well, 71% of tax receipts are entitlements. They are paying baby boomers $3.1 trillion per year cash out the door in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Okay. Baby boomers also have $75 to $100 trillion in assets. Does it make sense for us as a society to be borrowing money and having a Fed that basically takes from the poor and gives to the rich so that the rich can get paid the benefits that on average they don't need anyway? And I understand there's obviously on average it's a very fraught conversation. That to me is the conversation that needs to be happening, is why is the richest generation in the history of mankind getting $3.1 trillion in entitlements every year? That's conversation, because that forces the Fed to do what they do. It feeds back on itself. Question number two then is okay, defense. Why are we spending $900 billion a year on defense? Here too, these are tricky questions, because we're also spending $300 billion a year on VA. Literally what we spend on VA every year now is more than the entire deficit when we went into Iraq. Nobody ever talks about, there were a few four people with foresight and wisdom who said, listen, when you go to war, you create long-term liabilities that are very expensive and very much a drag on society. And in terms of the fiscal side, I'm not disparaging our veterans in any way. This is simply the math of it, of you have these liabilities. They're not paying them enough. Like, $300 billion is enough. The number should probably be $600 billion to really give all our veterans the care they deserve. But the math can't support that without... Now, the math could support that. The math can support anything it wants. The ultimate question is the value of the dollar and the bond market. It goes right back to that. And there is still a pseudo-religious, in terms of the dogma around it, group in Washington that is willing to sacrifice pretty much the U.S. working and middle classes, that bottom 90%, to support the real value of the bond market and the dollar. That's why we offshored. That's been economic and trade policy and foreign policy going back 40 years. And so the discussion is really around that is starting to happen post-COVID, because you couldn't get an audience about, hey, we need to massively weaken the dollar, reinvest, reshore, boost wages, let wage growth really, really skyrocket, hurt the real value of the bond market, have the Fed do yield curve control while we do this. You couldn't get, that was blasphemy, until Congress people's kids couldn't get masks because they're all made in China. Until the United States military runs out of 155-millimeter shells to Ukraine, because we don't make this stuff anymore. So there's actually a discussion for the first time that this 40-year policy, and this is Reuben, Summers, Clinton, Bush, Obama. This is all these guys. This is this. We will do whatever we have to do to the American middle and working classes in order to preserve the real value of the bond market and support the dollar. We will subjugate Americans to support the dollar and the treasury market. What COVID did, what Ukraine has continued to do in terms of supply chain problems, is identify that that cult of the dollar has gone too far, so much so that it is now a bigger national security threat than a weak dollar. And so ultimately, you started to see this with Trump, this sort of pseudo-industrial policy. It was messy. It was buffoonish. It was, you know, in terms of its lead, its lead advertiser. But it was the right thing to do. And now with Biden, very quietly, I don't get involved in politics. I try not to. I abhor them. I just try to watch what's happening. It is fascinating to me. Literally, Biden is running Trump's economic policy. I mean, it almost chapter and verse, in some ways better than Trump. And the people who literally hated Trump love Biden's economic policy. In the end, I don't care. For me, it tells me industrial policy is now U.S. policy. And there is we're in the early innings of a shift away from this cult of subjugate the U.S. industrial base, the defense industrial base, the U.S. middle class, the U.S. working class to support the dollar in the bond market to we are going to subjugate the bond market to rebuild, reshore, reinvest in the industrial base and the working class. So the conversation is happening, and that's kind of where I think we are with it.
Now, I am seeing some signs that, you know, there's a rebuilding of factories and things going on here in industrialization, largely driven by the fact that somebody bombed the Nord Stream pipeline, and we're seeing a lot of exfiltration of European industries into the U.S. market where natural gas is more stable and cheaper. So that all makes sense to me to a point. But, you know, what I'm confused by here is, you know, I saw this Ray Dalio chart from Bridgewater back in 2017, and it showed the total IOU plus debt of the United States expressed as GDP was 1,100% of GDP then. I don't know what it is today. And I said, Luke, there's only one question we have to resolve and ask. Who's going to eat the losses? So what you're telling me is that by making it all about the dollar and controlling the bond market, the losses are not going to be contained within the people, the creditors. They're going to try and make the debtors take the losses in the story. But that's the 90%, right? So while they've been running this program, we've seen...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we've seen the wealth, you know... If stopgap measures, it's an emergency, but that wealth gap has been growing for at least 15 years, and it's been growing like this. And so that is, like, whether you say that was an unintentional derivative effect of these other things they felt they had to do, it's still an effect, you know, and as Plutarch said, the oldest, most fatal ailment of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor. And so we're just creating this larger and larger wealth gap, and it's starting to rear its head in terms of lower productivity, potentially. People are checking out. They're not really working. They're like, why bother? You know, racking up credit card debts, never intending to pay them back.
It's 100%. And it's tricky because in a perfect world, they would have started this process shortly after the Berlin Wall came down. Start, okay, restructuring this stuff. Of course, that's not what we did. However, so it really comes down to the debtors versus the creditors, the bondholders versus the debtors, to your point. The debtor in this case is the U.S. government. So you really are going to have to inflate away the debt. That is going to create, yes, massive inflation. It's going to create asset inflation, which benefits the top 10%. Now, in theory, it also creates massive wage inflation. It creates profit margin compression, right? So right now we've got corporate profits that are near record highs, if not record highs. This would create a situation where corporate profit margin percentages fall, but corporate profit dollars rise. And the labor share comes off the floor of those profits and starts to rise, right? So if you're, you know, if you are the middle, call it, you know, from percentile 20 to percentile 80 in America, and you own your house with a fixed rate mortgage, and that fixed rate mortgage is probably comfortably under 4, and your wages are growing 10, and the government is controlling the bond market, that's going to be, if you can go through a period of a few years like that, you can rebalance and bring the, you know, the 20th through 80th percentile. Yes, their food bill is going to go up, but they're going to be getting a debt jubilee on their house, on the fixed rate loan portion of their car. Your corporate profit margins shrink, but the dollars rise with the inflation. It can all theoretically work, but I would readily admit it's very tricky, number one. Number two, the rise in labor wages are going to incent the investment in productivity enhancers, which are going to replace labor with technology broadly defined. And the other thing you're watching is immigration policy in this country is not being geared to do this. So if you're going to inflate to preserve the debtors, or to erode the real value of the debt. And again, I don't have a political view on this officially that I've ever made. I'm simply observing the flows. And then you're going to let 4 million workers in to compress and put a cap on the rate of labor to allow that inflation all to flow to corporate and the further widening of margins while further pressuring the lower end. You're getting into very dangerous ground. Peter Turchin, I read his latest book, and he highlights very brilliantly that elite overproduction, massive mm-hmm. wealth inequality, those are your big factors, and then technological change that creates, destabilizes, and creates insecurities. We've got all three of those things in spades, and in his latest book, I forget the name of it, he highlighted the U.S. is looking very much now like it did on those factors in the period 1850 to 1855. And obviously 1860 to 65 in this country were catastrophic. So I don't know that we're there yet, but again, how we manage this process, you're exactly right, is critical. And right now, unfortunately, to me, if you just let wages go, let the bond market go, let the Fed cap the bond market, and that's in the cake. That has to happen because the alternative is we go to the boomers and we say we need to balance the budget because this is the alternative. We need to balance the budget. The bond market is forcing us to. So boomers, if you look at the math, $3.1 trillion per year, which is for entitlements, and $900 billion a year roughly for defense. So I'll call it $4 trillion roughly. Okay, we're running a 7% fiscal deficit. So if we want to get a 7% of GDP fiscal deficit back to 2, we need to come up with 5 points of GDP to cut immediately and forever. 5 points of GDP on 27 trillion is 1.35 trillion of cuts immediately. Practically speaking, the only things big enough to cut that we talked about before, we've got $3.1 trillion of entitlements, $900 billion in defense, $1.1 trillion in interest. We can't cut interest. So the only things big enough to cut are entitlements and defense, really. We could nibble around the sides on the other stuff, but they're just simply not big enough. $1.35 trillion on $4 trillion is, what is that, 31, 32%? You would need to cut entitlements and defense by 30 to 35% tomorrow, permanently, forever, as your alternative. And here's the kicker. Because there's so much debt in the system, GDP is going to fall 5 points immediately. And so actually, you're going to wake up in 6 months and you're going to need to cut another 20% because the deficit that was 7 is actually going to be 8 now, not 2. Mm-hmm. Now you're in a debt death spiral. So that's why, like, this needed to happen 40 years ago. It didn't. 35 years ago. It didn't. So it really comes down to inflate. But are you going to inflate with an immigration policy that makes sense? And make sense is the key thing, right? Does it make sense to corporate America so their margins can go up and the 10% can get more and more? In the short run, I'm sure that makes sense to them. But the problem is we're now getting into the long run of these effects after the last 35, 40 years, and you're getting closer and closer to a catastrophic outcome in this country, politically, et cetera. Or are you going to run a policy, an immigration policy that makes sense for the 20 to 80%, which is we're capping immigration, we're going to let labor rates really go for a while, And we're going to basically give everybody a debt jubilee on their house. And in 4 or 5 years of 10% inflation, we're going to wake up and debt to GDP is going to be 70 to 80%. And GDP is going to be 40, 50 trillion because of the inflation. And wage rates have normalized somewhat. The labor share of GDP has gone up. Corporate profit percentages have gone down, but their dollars have gone up. That's the happy outcome. I don't see anybody having the foresight and the planning or the political ability to do that, unfortunately.
I don't either at this point. Now, I like to distinguish immigration I'm a fan of, migration, mm-mm. So we're facing migration right now, which is the mass movement of unvetted people from point A to point B. Immigration is a careful, thoughtful, multi-step process where you bring in the people you need, and that's totally awesome. My grandparents included, right? So that's fine.
Yeah, 100%. That's right. That's right. That's a very good, that's a very important distinction. Yeah.
Yeah. So, totally running a different process. So, the issue for me at this stage then is thinking about how we're going to get through this. So what would this look like if they lose control of this situation, right? So, the way I'm looking at it is you're mentioning these huge, giant structural changes that have to happen. And full confession. One of the side benefits of having unmanaged and unmedicated adult ADD is I fall down these rabbit holes, and I fell down this great taking rabbit hole where David Rogers Webb said, oh, hey, here's some stuff. So being me, I went and I read all of Title 11 and Title 12, which is bankruptcy and banking code, plus UCC 8. And I said, oh, and now we're back to that rogues gallery you mentioned, Rubin, all those guys, right? So they actually put in place a really weird set of rules that if people are already familiar with bank bail-ins, and we're familiar with that now, and we all understand that we're unsecured creditors when we give our money to a bank, but most people were unaware that that's also true in the financial space, where if you have what's called a security entitlement, which is a standard brokerage account, there are senior claimants, there are senior creditors within that structure. The problem I have, Luke, is I've asked lots of people, I've been through the legal departments at some of the big brokerages. Nobody can answer this question, which ought to be simple. How many senior creditors do you have, and who are they, and how much? They don't even know.
I had that book, The Great Taking, was sent to me by a couple different people, and I read it, and to be blunt, it scared the shit out of me. I feel like I'm fairly well read and involved. I did not know any of those things. And it's very disconcerting. I don't know David personally. I know in a former life, close friends of mine called on David's firm. He's a Cleveland guy. I'm in Cleveland. They're Shaker Investments. Mm-hmm. We knew them very well. We knew that firm very well. He is not, some lunatic. He is the furthest thing from it, which if you read the book, the level of diligence shows. It is a very unnerving thing. And you can see when you talk about these big shifts and what is essentially an increasingly shrinking window through which we need to fly in order to kind of get through the other side without triggering some sort of cataclysm that would put on the table the events or the actions described in that book, which is your wealth gets bailed in to collateralize these big banks and these big banks' derivative portfolios. And I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what to say beyond that, other than it is disconcerting, extremely disconcerting.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you had personal experience. It's almost irrelevant to me if he was who he said he was or not, because he gave all his references and I chased them all down because that's how I roll.
Really?
And yep. I read them all, and it's all there. So it's just in black and white. It's in the code. I've done a big series on it. I'm up to four almost hour long pieces just to dive in, get through the details, but it's there. And so my position is, look, they've installed the trigger. They've actually pulled it a couple times. We have five case precedents that have been through the Supreme Court, up two of them, right, which say they can do this. And the part that was most concerning to me, Luke, was finding out that, let's say, a brokerage or a clearing party goes into receivership. They're frozen. You can't get access to your funds until that process is complete. However, they are prevented by law from preventing what's called the adverse claimant from coming in and just reaching in, and they are prevented from them pulling out what they believe is theirs. So while the whole thing's frozen, one of these senior counterparties can come in and take cash or assets, depending on the nature of their qualified financial contracts, which are mostly derivatives. So I was like, wow, even the trustee or the receiver cannot prevent the taking if it gets to that point. And so when I've talked to a lot of people about this, and thank you for being so forthright about it, I usually run into this. They go, oh, that would never happen because that would be cataclysmic. And that's a hopes thing. And I don't like hope when it comes to this stuff. But is that a consideration that if it got to that point where we get another cataclysm, is this the springboard for how we get that 10x expansion of the Fed balance sheet? Because they say, our choices are, let this whole thing really like devolve and people's faith in capital markets destroyed. That probably has some impacts, we could imagine. Or do we print what's necessary for all these side bets to finally get made whole, which they already did? That's what they did with AIG and Goldman back in the day. Is that how we should be thinking about it, maybe?
If it came to that, I think that's the right frame. It keeps coming back to that same, that great decision of the bond market or the currency, right? If they upsize the Fed balance sheet by 10x, that's the currency. And if they grab everybody's wealth as collateral against it, that is save the bond market. And there is a political group that is more than happy to do that, you know. And it's one of these things, personally, as someone who manages my own money as well, has entered the realm of thought in no small part due to that book. I mean, I'd always been, having had a close enough seat in 08, you know, that was life-changing for me in terms of how and perspective-changing. This was another one of these moments where I read this and I go, okay, I don't know. I'm not politically connected enough to know when the push really comes to shove, which choice are they going to make? Are they going to print the money or trigger the revolution, right? This is, and I keep saying that, that's from Lia Kwad Ahmed's great book, Lords of Finance, after World War One. You know, Rudy Havenstein in Germany absolutely knew he was going to create severe rates of hyperinflation, but it really came down to a choice. Print the money or trigger the revolution. And this is what you're talking about with the great taking. You're going to print the money and just recollateralize, fully reserve all of it with printed money and let the dollar, the inflation level, be the release valve. The problem is, given the numbers involved, those numbers could easily run into the tens or hundreds of trillions of dollars of printing. And so you're not talking about a 10% increase in the inflation level. You're talking about something much greater. And how destabilizing is that versus the destabilization of, hey, you can't get your money. Thank you for playing. You know, I have friends that grew up in an Eastern Bloc country, and in, this is 1998, I think. So this is not that long ago. After the Soviet Union had already broken up, they told us that they were the richest family in the village. Their father was a doctor. They had enough money in the bank to buy five cars. And they closed the banks. 2 weeks later, they reopened the banks. And the money that had bought five cars when they closed the banks bought them a month of groceries after. Great taking. Thank you. And that's that. And when you talk about gold and silver, or in my opinion, Bitcoin, I never talked to them about Bitcoin, but I talked about gold and silver, and it's a very short conversation. There's no like, oh, well, why would I, no, like, oh, okay. Yeah. I said, how do people who own gold and silver do? Like, they were fine. Their purchasing power adjusted and there was a disruption, and sort of life goes on, you know. So I don't know politically which choice would be made. I do know the numbers are so big either way. You're either going to get extraordinarily disruptive inflation or you're going to get extraordinarily disruptive deflation. And again, in a fiat currency system, deflation, like what exactly you're going to create more problems for yourself than you solve. I mean, you solve the problem for a second, but then, so it's, I don't know which to do it, but I do know enough to know the numbers are big. The data is real. It's, so I don't know. I mean, you can kind of tell from my, like, it is, it's an important thing.
Well, I remember 2008-09 very well. I remember Hank Paulson marching down with a 2-page memo that cost the nation $780 billion, that when Bloomberg finally FOIA'd out all of the data from the Federal Reserve, it was actually $22 trillion of loans that they had to sort of like parse out. I found out that a lot of the mortgage-backed securities from that period of time had no mortgage. They were all BS, no M. Susan Trimbath taught us that, that there was actually, they were so busy creating paper that sometimes, oops, they created paper with no backing. And, you know, it's just part of the overt fraud that happened. And I remember from the, I can't remember who said it, but it was under Bush the second, where somebody said, in a time of crisis, the solutions that get adopted are the ones that are lying around. And that's my concern in this story is like, they say, oh, they would never do that. I said, but when a crisis comes, what are you going to default to? Some new thing or the laws on the books? You know, it's clearly, it's pretty obvious which way you go, but how that plays out politically, again, I don't have any insights either. You know, I guess I don't even know what to hope for in that scenario, but thank you for talking about that so openly, because that's certainly it's a thing.
It is. And it's one of these things where as an investor, as an individual, as a citizen, you need to think about it now. And I don't think it'll happen, but it's at the very least a fat tail risk.
Now, last question, and thank you for being so generous with your time. Is there any way, shape, or form that this idea of a central bank digital currency plays into this? Let me give you one scenario. Oh no, great crisis. Oh no, Luke, your portfolio has gone away. Bad news, SIPC isn't quite up to the task because it's such a big calamity. Good news, we'll give you a central bank digital currency account, which makes you whole. Dust settles, you wake up, you have spendable currency units, but you've lost, you don't own anything anymore. You don't own the means of production. That's like not yours. Is that a possibility? Or, you know, because I've heard people say, oh, if we get into a big crisis, this is when the central bank digital currency comes out. And I don't understand how it solves anything. If we just denominate the debts and liabilities and the IOUs in something different than the thing it was in, I don't get it. Is there a path there I'm missing?
I think it would have to be the path that my friends went through in the Eastern European country, which is to say the CBDC is denominated, you know, 100 to 1. Right. So for every $100 you had, you now get one CBDC and the purchasing power adjusts accordingly. That kind of a thing. I think that's implied. And the CBDC thing to me is very dangerous. You know, I wrote the other day on Twitter, I said, look, if you do not have the ability as a citizen to escape out of the currency into gold, into Bitcoin, then you are no longer in a democracy. You are no longer in a republic. You are no longer in capitalism. And that, it's that big a deal, in my opinion. You know, Howard Buffett, Warren's dad, wrote Human Freedom Rests on Gold Redeemable Currency in 1948. Most people in our business I've only read everything that Warren Buffett has ever said about gold, but never anything what Warren Buffett's dad has said about gold. And it hasn't mattered for a long, long time because these are, as you know, long cycles of human history. And we're now just getting to the age where sort of anybody who remembered this lesson because they were taught up close and personal has died. And so we're dancing very near the edge of very dangerous territory in terms of, you know, and so I, for me, the CBDC, I wouldn't rule out anything. I don't know well enough to know, I can see the structures of those things, and I've read enough about human history and nature, and it really, I'm reading, you know, The Storm Before the Storm right now about, you know, sort of the end of the Roman Republic era, right? So sort of, you know, 125
Yep.
BC and everything. And they're going through the same problem with this Lex Agraria, right? Where like the wealthy have all the lands and it's starting to become a problem. And do we, who do we make a citizen? Who do we not? And there's political infighting and those with the entrenched interests don't want to give an inch. And so it's sort of the same human nature cycle that plays out over and over and over. It's fear and greed, fear and greed. We're now getting to this point where you can sort of see, okay, the great taking, the pay, you know, things are lined up, the balance sheet lined up, CBDC discussed. I don't know how these things will play out. I know what would happen depending on if any of them are chosen and I put into place. I think I do. I think I can see at least the first and second derivative likely implications for asset prices and freedom levels and domestic political stability and so on. And so then from there you go, okay, how do I prepare? How do I diversify? How do I hedge? What am I looking for? What are possible triggers? And it's a little bit of the old Robert Mapplethorpe, you know, art, you know, this is, you know, from the late 80s down and, you know, I'll know obscene when I see it. You know, I know obscene. I'll know the trigger when I see it. I have high confidence in that. I know to be looking for it. I think I'll know it when I see it. And if not, I'll see it soon enough in the markets. The markets will tell me, hey, you know, the price action, something's happening here. Wake up, dummy. And then I'll wake up. But that's how I'm thinking about it as a person, as an investor, as an advisor, as a consultant. I'm looking at these things and I think they're all important. I think they're all real. I think they're highly political. I think there's a lot of potential triggers. And just trying to keep an open mind and being flexible, balanced, unlevered, and watching.
Well, fantastic. So I have to ask this too, then, because people ask me about gold and silver a lot, like it's one word. And I say two words. Gold is a monetary asset, you know, tier one, according to Basel III. It's sitting there. And I'm watching all this stuff developing with the BRICS. We're moving from a unipolar to clearly a multipolar world, whether the U.S. knows that or not, or hates it or loves it, doesn't matter. It's happening. And I'm watching, and I was watching for the how are the BRICS going to start to resolve this? And they said, we kind of want to do bilateral cross-border trading with each other rather than establishing a dollar reserve asset sort of competitor. And on the back of that, so here's why I like gold. It's a monetary asset, and I don't think it's been appropriately priced in yet, but I'd love your thoughts on this, that it has an embedded out-of-the-money call option baked into it, which is that, oh, if this thing gets monetized again on that basis, it's a call option. This thing's going up in price. Divide by your favorite M2 aggregate and figure it out, right? What are your thoughts on that?
100%. You know, it's a great bookend to what we started talking about with energy, right? Because I talked about, you know, the floor and ceiling, the declining ceiling and the rising floor in terms of the oil price that blows up the debt and the oil price that keeps the supply of oil growing. And at some point, those two cross and then you're done, right? You're upside down. And that's before that cross, you need to change the monetary system to one that where oil and commodities are not only priced in dollars, they're priced in all, at least the SDR currencies, but let's just say all currencies. And then you end up with like you said, bilateral trade, China and Saudi trade in yuan. And then Saudi ends up with yuan. And then Saudi buys Chinese goods with the yuan, because China's the factory of the world, and anything that's left over on net gets settled in physical gold. Because China has set up this system whereby you can exchange offshore yuan into gold in a variety of places, Shanghai, Hong Kong, London, Singapore. And the price of gold over time rises in yuan terms. It is our currency and our problem as opposed to the dollar, which is our currency, but your problem, because you're getting treasuries and your treasuries are losing purchasing power. Your gold is gaining yuan purchasing power. So you're happy to trade in yuan if you're Saudi, if you're Iran, if you're Brazil, if you're the BRICS, because you're going to, it's being backed by basically the world's factory. My yuan are good for Chinese goods, which are obviously moving well up the value chain when we're talking about them being a threat to our assets in space. And anything left over, net settled in gold at a floating price. And that is the fix to this energy problem. This is ultimately what I call is this oil re-becoming an oil currency. Ultimately, when you look at the imbalances of physical trade around the world, a substantial portion of them are around commodities. Either somebody has them and doesn't have anything else, and so they're running big surpluses, or somebody doesn't have them and does a lot of everything else and needs the commodities. And so that's, gold fills that hole. And as it does, to your point, it has to get way bigger. I mean, just one example we've used in our research, the physical oil market, annual production dollar terms, is 12 to 15 times the size of the annual gold physical production terms. That's just oil. That's not gas, copper, nickel, iron ore, so on and so forth. So I think that is already begun. I think that is going to accelerate this gold re-becoming an oil currency. And I think Wall Street is completely offsides on this. They're still looking at gold through the old lens of what are real rates, what's the dollar, what's the Fed going to do, which is incredible because gold separated from U.S. real rates 2 years ago, 18 months ago, forever gold and U.S. real rates traded. And they completely diverted 18 months ago. So that's already, when you get a divergence like that macro, that's something important happening. And I think the next divergence is going to be, we're going to wake up in 3 months and gold's going to be 2,400, 2,500. And people are going to, wait, what? Why? I don't understand. And then 2,800. And at some point, there's going to be this recognition that it is re-becoming an oil currency. People say, oh, the BRICS, they don't trust each other. They're never going to. Exactly. They don't trust each other. So guess what they're going to use? Gold. Well, how are they going to do that? Well, the United States used to fly a plane from America to Riyadh like once a month, full of bullion in the late 40s, early 50s. Like, we drink water bottles, right? We send water bottles around on trucks all over the place. It makes zero sense, but we do it. Is it energy intensive? Absolutely. We do it. You don't think people will say, I mean, someone's going to say the system is basically no tiki, no washi. Like, you send the gold or else the next shipment of oil ain't coming. And that's how it'll work. And it will require, it's basically the oil market bidding for the gold market, the commodity market bidding for the gold market. Physical only. This is not paper. They don't want paper IOUs. That's just a dollar construct. And I think a call option on gold or call option on that is the right way to frame it. I think the gold market, gold is re-becoming an oil currency. Silver is more an industrial metal. I think it'll be fine, but I think the real juice is in, gold.
Fantastic. Well, I could keep this conversation going forever and ever. And we'll hopefully repeat it soon and carry on. Luke, how do people follow you and your excellent work, please?
Oh, thank you. I'm fftt-llc.com for more information about our institutional and mass market products. And then on Twitter, or I guess it's X now. I always say Twitter still. Sorry, Elon.
Yeah, it's still Twitter. Sorry.
on X at Luke Groman, LukeGroman.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for your time today. And I hope we can do this again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Hello, Chris Martinson. I'm the CEO of Peak Prosperity and also Peak Financial Investing. And after watching that, you're probably wondering, well, what do I do with my money? Look, you both deserve and need somebody who can talk to you about what's really going on in this world, understand the situation as it is, not be steering you towards certain things that don't make sense for you or just keep you in a game that's already ended. Look, if you want to talk to somebody about the petrodollar declining, or what is happening with gold, or which sectors are actually the best ones to be in, given what the Federal Reserve is up to or the federal government, you deserve to talk to somebody who can answer those and has a few gray hairs and has been there through some of the economic cycles because, hey, we're in another economic cycle, so it's good to have that experience. Fortunately, at Peak Financial Investing, what we do is we go out and we scour and we look for the very best firms out there who satisfy one thing above all else. They've got great experience coupled to great customer service. So if you want to come by peakfinancialinvesting.com, there's a very simple form you can fill out. Just a few fields. You hit send. What happens is an email gets triggered out. It goes to an endorsed firm of ours. You will get an email back. You can then set up a phone call for a 30 to 45 minute free, no obligation, no pressure call to find out if this firm is a good fit for you and to find out if you're a good fit for the firm. It has to go both ways. And if all that matches up, this will be one of the best things that could happen to you this year. So please come by peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple process. We would love to help you if we can. Thanks very much.